the white now in Liberia has become Chinese. And that's the most stark example I can give you of just how so many countries in Africa are shifting these days, and kind of what I think the immediate effect of an American pullback from these countries would mean.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Tucson, Arizona today, and I'm joined in Washington by a new guest that I'm very pleased to welcome to the table, Helene Cooper, who is a Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. She is also the author of the newly released book, Madam President, The Extraordinary Journey of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, which I strongly recommend to everybody to go out and immediately buy. In fact, stop listening to the podcast, go to Amazon, order it, and then start listening to the podcast again. Not only is it a wonderful book, but Helene is one of my three favorite people in Washington, and I don't know who the other two are. So it's definitely something that's worthy of your attention. By the way, we've received some very, very sad pleas from you guys out there why you ER nerds need a mug so badly. We love them. We love your pain. Keep sending us these sad pleas. We'll send some of you mugs. Others, you will just have to continue to suffer and send more sad pleas. But this cycle of pain is what keeps us going strong here at the ER. Email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. So, recently, from a tiny studio in sweltering Tucson, and from our tiny podcast studio high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. So, in the last episode, we talked about Madam President, The Extraordinary Journey of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf by Helene Cooper, the Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. And we talked about sort of the book and about the events that have marked the presidency of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. I'd like to sort of expand it out, tease it out a little bit now, and talk about what are some of the broader lessons that you have learned from writing the book about the role of women in politics, about the relationship, about the future of politics in Africa, about the relationship between Western powers and leaders in Africa. Particularly as we seem to be going through a kind of a rethinking of how we're going to approach all that. And others are coming into play, like the Chinese and so forth. So let me start with the first issue, the issue of the broader implications around women and politics. Do you think there's a future for women in Liberian politics? Do you think that the relative success of somebody like Ellen Johnson Sirleaf will produce more women leaders in West Africa, elsewhere in Africa? Do you think something is happening here that's deeper, or that this was more of a one-off?
I absolutely think there's a future for women in politics in Liberia, in West Africa, and in Africa as a whole. And I think it goes back to, it's not only Liberian women who were market women and who, you know, drove the, you know, carried the country economically on their backs throughout the wars. This is something that's that is the case with women across Africa. I was in the Congo back in 2005, and I remember coming into Bukavu, Eastern Congo. And as I was coming into the city in a car at twilight, I saw this woman walking up the hill, and she had all these logs on her shoulders. She was stooped so much because of the bamboo sticks on her shoulders. And in front of her was her husband, and he had nothing. He had nothing in his hands, nothing on his shoulders. He carried nothing. And he kept turning around, telling her to hurry up. And she kept moving ahead. And that woman has sort of stuck with me as I've worked on this book, because she is so representative of women all across Africa who carry that entire continent on their backs. They work harder. They are the market women. They're plowing the fields. They're carrying the wood. They're caring for the children. They literally have been doing it all, with the exception of running the country politically. Now, what happened in Liberia, where these market women realized that they could turn their their economic work and their economic control into political control. I think women across Africa are realizing that. So many women, while I was working on the book, kept coming. Every week, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf helped, you know, would have this listening session with these women from across Africa that came in to talk to her about how she did it and, you know, get her advice of how they could run for office as well. And I think that's something now in Liberia, even though we don't have, I don't think there's a credible woman this year running to replace Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, but I think it almost would be as hard to imagine a woman succeeding Ellen right now as it would be to imagine a black guy succeeding Barack Obama in 2016. I think the country almost sort of felt like they need a break. But at the same time,
so orange became the new black.
Do we still have our ban against talking about?
Yeah, I didn't say anybody okay. specific. Not mentioning it.
But when you go to when I went to elementary schools around Liberia, Monrovia, and upcountry, there were always these little girls there who said they could be president, and that was one of the things that just cheered me enormously. So I think we're definitely going to see more and more of that. It may take time, but she's broken that barrier, and I can't imagine there were not going to be a lot more coming after her.
Do you see signs of that elsewhere in Africa right now?
I had started to, you know, I really thought the Joyce Banda appointment in Malawi was won, but it turns out she wasn't elected. She was appointed. And then she only lasted about a year before she flamed out. So that's not really an apt comparison. You mentioned Rwanda, where you see so many women in parliament, and it's hard to imagine that there's not a it's not going to be a logical jump from that to the executive branch. You know, you see women in some countries in Africa who are in the number two positions, but I think we're getting to the point now where it's soon not going to seem to be that out of the ordinary.
Yeah, and of course, we made one of our diplomats of the year this year, Hafsat Abiola, who is really doing a lot, I think, to promote democracy in Nigeria after the tragedies that befell her family. And so at another level down in a lot of these countries, there are women hard at work trying to promote democracy or trying to promote social change in one way or another.
Like your original thesis, David. David's yeah. original thesis, to anybody who didn't listen, his original idea for my book was for me to go spend all my time in Saudi Arabia writing about how, you know, Saudi Arabia was horrible because they didn't treat their women well. And I didn't really want to spend a year in Saudi Arabia, so I wrote this instead.
I felt it was a little broader than that. I thought there were a lot of shitty places you could go.
I know. You'd come up with some it was like Somalia, Saudi Arabia. I would literally have spent my entire book leave in like Afghanistan, Somalia,
Waziristan.
Exactly.
Exactly. Excuse me, sir.
This sounds like a really great book, but I don't even know if I'd be able to drink.
Excuse me, Mr. Taliban. You shot that Malala girl. I'm just here to ask why.
I didn't want to do that.
Yeah, no, and frankly, I think the result, which is to focus in on a very specific case, is useful because it gives a real success story. You know, the great thing about the book is that it's qualified enough. It's real.
Yes.
You know, she's not perfect.
She's not.
And her outcomes are not perfect, but it showed that kind of adaptability. You know, I think you were talking earlier in the first half of this, which we aired recently. One of the things that it struck me is that really good politicians have to kind of be translators between the bulk of the people in their country and the elites in their country, or the bulk of the people in their country and the rest of the world. So you have to be able to shift back and forth between languages. Bill Clinton was really, really good at that. Even George W. Bush, you know, country Texas.
He could do it. Yeah, he definitely
could. When he had
to
do it, he shifted back and forth about that. And it seems like this is an important skill set which she natively had.
It's so interesting you bring that up because that was – both the block for us as I started doing the book, and then it opened her up for me. When I first started working on the book, I interviewed her in American English. She and I both can speak like this because we've both gone to school in the United States. And I was coming to her as, oh, I'm a New York Times reporter. I just covered the White House. Yeah, I'm from Liberia, but, you know, I'm a journalist here to interview you, and I'm going to ask my hard-hitting journalistic questions in American English, which is the English that this is the language that I work in. And she was perfectly fine answering me like that. But we never got anywhere. I was getting these really canned answers. I was getting all of this reserve. I was getting a lot of, you know, talking points. She's smart enough to be able to go beyond talking points, but I wasn't getting kind of emotion I wanted. I wasn't getting the frankness that I was looking for, and I felt like I wasn't getting the real Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. And then for some reason, in the middle of a conversation, we're both in the back seat of her car on a country tour up country, and I was shadowing her around. And something happened outside. I think we had stopped at a market, and this market woman came up, and we were both talking to the market woman in Liberian English. And when we started writing again, we continued in Liberian English. And I realized as we were talking to each other in Liberian English that it was like a floodgate had just opened up. I was getting far more real answers. She was funny. She was actually hilarious. And she was much more at home in it, in much the same way that I was. And after that, I stopped interviewing her in American, switched to Liberian.
You sounded like you were about to tell us how she was hilarious, and I just have to ask, how was she hilarious?
She has a sense of humor. You know, she's like, she's got this subversive sense of Liberian. Find humor in the most, we're so un-PC, and we're so, you know, we will make fun in the middle of a war about people who are hobbling on the street because they got shot. It's never politically correct. And she has that same subversive, you know, sense of humor that you wouldn't expect.
Well, how does Liberian English differ from American English?
If I were doing it in Liberian English, I would be talking like that. You want me to talk Liberian English for the rest of the podcast?
Yeah, I like that. It really adds a degree of authenticity. I could talk Jersey.
You talk Jersey, I'll talk Liberian. We'll see how long we can go.
I don't know. The problem with Jersey is it's just too crude.
Your Jersey isn't even legit anymore. You're such an intellectual elite. What are you talking about, Jersey?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. This hurts so much.
Can you do it, David? I want to hear your Jersey. You made me do Liberian English.
What are you talking about? I'm like from New Jersey. I like talk like from New Jersey. I talk about going down the shore, and the first greeting is like "fuck you," and then the other guy says "oh fuck you," and then he's "hey fuck you," you know, and it's like back and forth. Somebody sent in one of these mug requests recently, and they said they wanted two mugs so they could hold them over their kids' ears. When I started going to the F-bombs on the show.
This mug thing is really, like, it's totally confusing. I'm going to have to start listening to the podcast more regularly.
Actually, I'm sure if are you facing Maria right now?
I'm facing Maria. I've already, like, yes. And you should see, she's making these huge, she's been making faces all the while that you were talking, Jersey.
Yeah, but I'm sure she's FYI. Like, if you talked about the mugs, she's holding her head in her hands. Because, you know, she is like, she's the director of communications and foreign policy. She's got a real job.
Like,
but there's so many demands for these mugs all the time that we now have
that is so
special
weird.
Full-time mug assistant in the company. So someday we'll make them available for people to buy, and then the interest will dry up right away, I'm sure. Let's get to this other sort of the broader implications here. And that has to do with the relationship between countries like Liberia and the rest of the world. We have this turn inward, and I am going to avoid over-focus on the current administration in the U.S., but we can't avoid it altogether. There is this kind of movement towards nationalism and dealing with local problems in the U.S. and in Europe, and the challenges that exist in Africa are still immense. And frankly, if the richest country in the world starts pulling back on things like aid, support for multilateral institutions, and so forth, it seems to me that that is a potential crisis for Africa. But maybe there's an alternative view. Maybe there's a view that they're just going to have to you know, do it on their own, and this stuff doesn't help so much. What's your view?
Or at they this or they turn to the Chinese, who are all over and, you know, dying to get in more in Africa, to the point now when I was in when I was growing up in Liberia, not that long ago.
If that's your story, you stick with it.
We would see, I remember as a kid, we would see, it wasn't often that we saw that many white people, especially when we're up country at my dad's farm. And we'd all say, look, white man, white man, white man. And we'd yell and, you know, point at them. And now I was up country.
That, by the way, is how you usually greet me when we're lunch.
That's how I go to the farm. I'm like, white man, man. But now it's upcountry. A short while ago, with my a Greek friend of mine, Danai Patelli, who was visiting me. She'd just gotten a degree in women's history, and she was supposedly helping me do research and interviews for the book. Even though we spent more time cavorting around Liberia, drinking in bars than anything, but at one point we were upcountry. In Banga, but we're outside of Banga, which is a fairly big town, but we're outside of Banga going through this village, and the kids came running to the side of the road because we had a flat tire and we stood outside, we were standing outside the car trying to figure out what the hell we were going to do. And they're all looking at Danai, who looks like your normal Greek woman, and they're all going, Chinese lady, Chinese lady, Chinese lady. And this wow. These days, anytime, if you went to Liberia and you go up country, you go outside of Monrovia and you go into the bush, people will identify you as Chinese man because the white now in Liberia has become Chinese. And that's the most stark example I can give you of just how so many countries in Africa are shifting these days and kind of what I think the immediate effect of an American pullback from these countries would mean. It just means that the Chinese step in to fill in that space. I think you're absolutely right when you say some of these countries need to learn how to survive by themselves, and certainly Liberia is one of them. And I think I very much hope that if Liberia is not receiving, not that it gets that much money anyway from the U.S., but whatever, if it's not receiving as much American aid as it used to, Liberians will be more likely to fend for themselves. But you're still talking about a pretty desperately poor country. So people who are really, really poor are going to do whatever they can to get fed and to get their, you know, to maintain their life. And we're not talking about extravagant lifestyles here. We're talking about a lot of people who are not even getting two meals a day, you know, one meal a day, let alone two. And so they're going to do what they can to survive. And if that means, you know, it means doing whatever they can. They also, I think obviously, I have huge issues with the idea of the United States turning inward. And I just want to say two more things about that. One is that at the Pentagon, which I cover, they worry a lot about what they call the youth bulge in Africa. The AFRICOM people and the military advisors who deal with Africa worry so much about that because there's so many unemployed young men in these African countries. And those are the people who are the most likely to be prey to radical Islamic groups because they're vulnerable and they don't have anything else to turn to. I think that's something that, you know, we should be paying attention to when we're talking about just yanking help away. And then the other thing is, God, this country would so suck if there were no immigrants here. And if we were only, where would you or I be?
Someplace else.
Obviously,
I wouldn't have made it because my dad's family, you know, everybody in his family was killed. So we would have just died in the Holocaust. But it's true. It would be a much less interesting place.
Yeah. Yeah.
But having said that, if you go and talk, as you do in the Pentagon, to people in the military about where do you see hotspots in the future, where should we focus, where are the potential problems / opportunities, high on the list, you know, after you get through the immediate challenges, which are almost invariably listed as Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea in some order, you get to Africa and you say, this is the place we need to focus on in the future. We need to focus on this because Islamic and other forms of extremism are spreading there much more rapidly. Islamist, excuse me, but mm-hmm. and other forms of extremism are spreading there rapidly. We talk about issues like Ebola and other kinds of diseases which may have global consequences coming out of there. We talk about rising powers with a lot of resources, where the Chinese are coming in and buying up the resources. So there's a strategic play there, and so forth.
And don't forget climate change, because it's on display there in ways that you can't even imagine.
Right. And so, you know, we've got this, and then you sort of look at U.S. policy towards Africa, which is important because we're the richest, most powerful country in the world. And actually, you know, George W. Bush, particularly in the second term of his administration with the Millennium Challenge and a bunch of other things, actually did quite a bit focused on Africa. Mm-hmm. And actually, Obama was kind of slow to start.
He was.
But he did the African Young Leaders, and he did the big electric power project, mm-hmm. you know, thing. One of the things we know about this administration is that if Obama did it, they don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Another thing we know is that they don't particularly like development spending. And so it seems like all the tools that we've got in our toolbox to help improve relations with Africa may get set aside, and that this may be really fateful in terms of the near, medium, and long term of U.S. foreign policy and geopolitics. Am I overstating that? Or?
No, you're not. But I think that's the case, you know, almost around the world, but certainly for Africa. I mean, I did one story in January looking at the new administration's sort of the questions they were asking about Africa. And those indicated this huge skepticism toward development aid. And, you know,
you can go back into Liberian English anytime you want, if that's easy.
You want me to do the res in Liberian?
I'm sure our listeners do.
But no, there's different. I don't think, and I'm gonna keep to this. You said you didn't want to mention the President of the United States by name,
right?
So I can do this. But
yeah,
I don't.
You
think
can just
that,
refer to him as yeah. Voldemort, or he whose name
good grief.
Shall not be spoken, or something like that.
But I don't think Africa is something that he's thought of at all outside of the terrorism context. And so it's not something that's even remotely on his radar. So then you look at the next question you ask is then, who does he appoint at the State Department, to who's going to be the one, you know, jumping up and down, or at the NSC? And, you know the answer to that. We still don't have anybody. So I'm not optimistic.
Yeah, we certainly haven't seen major focus on Africa policy.
No.
We don't have a deputy secretary of state. We don't even know where the secretary of state is as in this particular broadcast.
Isn't he in,
he's in Asia, but then he left. As we were recording, he was like in Japan, and then he was like, or someplace, and he got like pooped. And he was
don't
like,
forget, without a press corps with one right-wing blogger.
Right, a right-wing blogger who's not actually blogging. What's going on? And so he's like missing in action, literally, and in every other respect of the way that you can
talk
about.
Hey, I cover the Pentagon. I have a good sec def.
You do have a good sec def. And now you've got a deputy nominated,
yeah,
at least.
Yeah.
And no undersecretaries.
Hey, these things take time.
And all the sort of service secretaries like got conflicted out.
Yeah, they all flamed out. There will be no Vinnie Viola at the Army.
Yeah, that's a pity, because that would have been quite colorful. But I guess this is the interesting thing is this administration is so obsessed with the deep state. But if they don't actually appoint people to run the government, who's left to run the government?
Well, maybe that's the point.
Yeah, that is. Maybe they're actually secretly working for the deep. That's really confusing. Well, what do you think the next steps for the international community are with regard to Africa? I mean, is there something that can or should mm-hmm. be done? When you walked away, when you left, you finished this book, you closed it, and, you know, the angels of your better nature were sitting on your shoulder discussing what could come out of this thing.
I have enormous hope for Africa. I mean, you go around. This is a continent that I've been. I've my I've traveled around for my entire life, including the 23 years that I was not going to Liberia. I was going to other parts of Africa. And it's so different. It's so much more vibrant now. You go to Accra, which is the real African thriving city. You move around through Nigeria with all of its problems. It's a cacophonous democracy, you know, and we're moving away. I mean, we still have these strongmen dictators who don't believe in leaving until, I'm not going to say that, but because then it'll sound like I'm trying to kill them, but who don't leave until they die in office, like Idris Deby in Chad or Paul Biya, who's been around in Cameroon since, you know, since before I was born, I think. And you still have Mugabe, but that is becoming less of a norm. And I think you're going to see more Ellen Johnson Sirleafs who leave, you know, after their term or after they're voted out of office. So I have, and then the continent is, you, I know you tend to, when you go to Africa, you tend to go on safari, right? Have you been to West Africa yet? Or you just
I haven't been in the, first of all,
okay, that's ridiculous. You need to get to West Africa. You were, weren't you just on safari?
No, I was in Liberia.
When were you in Liberia? Actually,
like 15 years ago. I was also in Abidjan in Cote d'Ivoire.
You were in Liberia 15 years ago, David Rothkopf?
Yeah. I mean, I was there for like a day and a half.
See, that doesn't count. I can't believe you're coming up with this one day business talking about I was in Liberia.
It was just like, have I been there? Have I not been there? You know, but I mean, I like, I've been to these, but you're right. I should go to West Africa. I absolutely should.
And I'm going. Yeah. So seriously.
And I'm planning to go to East Africa and I'm doing some stuff there in August. So I really do feel I want to spend more time focusing on what's going on there.
You know what I'd love to do is sit in a Liberian restaurant with you and watch you try to get your salmon with the sauce on the side. That's what I want to see.
Wow. Wow. It's so painful. It's so painful. And where do you spend your vacations in the summertime, Aline? In Liberia? Is the olive?
I just spent Christmas in Liberia. Thank you very much.
Really?
Yes.
What is Christmas like in Liberia?
It was awesome. My whole family went. And so everybody from my 82-year-old mom to my 6-year-old half-Serbian, half-Liberian nephew, who'd never been in Africa before, and he'd never been around so many black people in his life, which was hilarious. And he didn't even know. We kept wondering because it's like he's never been to Africa before. So he's never been in a place where he's never really been in a place where black people were not the minority. And so but he didn't notice the colors at all. I mean, he noticed the colors, but he didn't notice the colors of the people at all, which is really interesting for a 6-year-old. I thought he would, you know, he would say something or he would ask, but there was none of that. But we had a ball. A lot of ways, that's a sign of how much better Liberia has gotten under the rule of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, because it would have been unthinkable 15 years ago for my family to go to Liberia for Christmas, let alone take our pride and joy Cooper, the 6-year-old.
But Santa Claus? I mean,
Santa Claus, honey. We got Santa Claus. Yeah. Santa Claus is not a white guy in a red suit with a beard. He is a tall African giant dressed up like a witch doctor with the hat and the whole outfit, usually on stilts, that comes singing, we are Santa Claus, we are. Hey. And he comes singing into your yard and you got to give him money.
You have to give him money?
Yeah, you got to give him money.
This is where the whole culture of corruption starts.
Oh, whatever.
It's not like your Santa Claus comes and shakes down people
at
Christmas time?
Please don't bring your westernized notions of over to me. Our Santa Claus is rock.
No, it sounds good. It sounds like a big improvement. In fact, I think we should do a whole feature somewhere in Foreign Policy on Santa Clauses of the world.
That would be cool. I want to do the Liberia one.
Yeah, no, I think that would be something really to look forward to. Tell me, before we only have a couple of minutes, has the book been released in Liberia?
No, because we don't have a publishing industry there. But Liberians have not hesitated to give their opinion on it anyway, even though they haven't read
any,
they haven't read it, but there are a lot. It's been reviewed by Front Page Africa, which is the big newspaper daily in Liberia, and Rodney Sia, who is a legendary reporter, journalist with Front Page Africa, and it's certainly been a subject of a lot of political discourse in Liberia, even though most people there haven't read it, because Ellen Johnson Sirleaf as president. So all of her opponents want to dissect the book, and her proponents want to talk about it too. So it's been interesting watching the sort of the Liberian chatter about it.
What's controversial about it there?
Oh, everything. Absolutely everything. Everything. People are interested in sort of the criticism of her, and they're also interested, but they also take a lot of the talk around the book. And again, this is from people who haven't read it, is that that because she cooperated with me for the book, that it's going to be a book that's too much in her corner. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff coming from her political opponents.
I see. So the people, they find stuff that they can use against her, they will use it against her, and otherwise you're too much in her corner.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it sounds, Liberian politics do work a little bit like American politics,
don't they? Oh, it's quite similar.
Well, that's very interesting. And I think the response of the book and the reviews of the book and everything here has been going extremely well. And the reason for that is that Madam President, The Extraordinary Journey of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is a great book by a great reporter. And for those of you who've listened in to these past two podcasts, you now know why Helene Cooper is one of my favorite people in Washington. And I'm so glad this book has been done.
That is so nice of you.
Well, no, it's true. And it's why I can't wait, you know, another 10 years for the next book.
You know, that's the average length of time I take.
Well, but they all turn out good. You know, I mean, these books are like really, really important books. And
okay,
you know,
I'll buy you lunch at Bar DuPont. You can give me my next idea.
Okay. It's a good deal. But I'm thinking Santa Claus is from around the world. I think that's a
350 pages of Santa Claus is from around the world.
The Liberian Santa Claus sounds like it'd be a whole book.
He totally could.
Yeah, I know. I'm really looking forward to that. Anyway, go read the book, guys. It's really, you know, it's something to read. And my book doesn't come out till April 9th, so it gives you something to do between now.
Jeez, you're already on another one?
Well, it's a small one.
Good God.
It's a TED book.
What is this one about?
It's called Great Questions of Tomorrow. It's about how technology is changing the world and how when you get to a big period of sort of transformational change like this, you've got to go back to really fundamental questions like what's the social contract? What is a government? How do we organize ourselves? What is the purpose of society? That kind of
absolutely.
Thing.
That sounds cool. You
know, no, it's cool, but it's because it's a TED book. It's like 100 pages long. So.
Oh, wow.
You know, you could read all TED books are designed so you could read them on the shuttle flight from New York to Washington or something like that. I mean that.
Yeah.
Full of love for TED. Anyway, well, this has been great. Thank you, Helene. We should have you come back more often. But next step will be to have that lunch and to plan your next book, because I love nothing better than the 10 years of agony. As you struggle to produce the books, they end up being great works of reportage and literature also. But I get the best scene. Your
it's
friends
the heart
get the
that
best
makes
scene.
It good, man.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. All right, thank you, Helene. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we welcome you back next week for two more episodes of the ER.
You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I have been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori with the assistance of Alex Dorr. For more information about FP and to subscribe to The ER and our Global Thinkers podcast, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, or Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you very much for joining us.